Freedom Betrayed, Herbert Hoover's Secret History of the Second World War and its Aftermath. That is our subject tonight. But first, I've got to say a few words about Ishkom. We used to have one of the most advanced and cost-effective electricity providers in the world, one of the cheapest electricities in the world, and power failures were unknown. However, something happened in 1994 that changed that, and now we've got what they call load shedding. What on earth is load shedding? It's a blackout power failure, scheduled power failure, but the government doesn't like to use the word power failure, so the word load shedding. Yeah, this is like calling massacre of civilians collateral damage, or abortion a removal of the product of conception, or the TOP, termination of pregnancy bill. These are just euphemisms. When governments speak about liquidating or executive action, which is assassination, and they speak about strategic bombing, which is genocide of entire cities, incinerating hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children. I mean, they're called strategic bombing. And in South Africa, they call power failure, blackouts, load shedding. We don't always supply you with electricity, but when we do, please don't use it. This is one of the few electricity providers in the world that don't want their customers to actually use the product that they're selling. And if you want to know why our power failures happen, well, just look at some of the generators and power stations and the chaos that happens when these things blow up because they weren't maintained. After 11 years and over 200 billion rand, that's billion with a B, not a single unit at the Kusiel power station is running. You'll get more electricity out of a single battery than you will out of this $200 billion and counting power station. Oh, well, of course. You know that there's something wrong when the country's electricity provider has a generator outside. But don't worry, they're on top of it. And the whole situation in the country is, one of darkness. And Ishkom no longer is being referred to with electric light bulb, but with a candle. And yes, Ishkom. What did South Africans use before candles? Electricity, just like the people in Zimbabwe. What's the difference between South Africa and the Titanic? When the Titanic went down, the lights were on. State of electricity in South Africa. AC, alternating current. DC, direct current. ANC, absolutely no current. Would you believe that the poor people in Zimbabwe are having to endure load shedding because South Africa has been providing them with free electricity because they haven't paid their hundreds of millions in debts? Same with Zambia and Zimbabwe and others. They now have to have load shedding because South African power is going off, which is shame. Not that they've paid for the electricity, but anyway. So Eskom's failed, the South African Airways has failed, Danel has failed, SABS has failed, SABC has failed, SANRAIL has failed, the Road Accident Fund failed, Price has failed, the Post has failed, Source has failed. But if we nationalize the bank, that's going to solve all the problems. And healthcare. Load shedding is what you get when 20% of the population pays and 80% get it for free. It's not good economics. ANC stands for Another Night with Candles. At least they committed to improving people's romantic lives that you can have more candlelit dinners. ANC stands for arrogance, nepotism, and corruption, or abortion, nepotism, and communism. There's a whole lot of things. But remember, the middle letters of cancer is ANC. You know what a cancer is? A cancer is a cell that doesn't contribute to the health of the body, breaks down the health of the body. That is why I say the ANC is a cancer. They are like a tick. Polyticks. Polymini ticks, blood-sucking parasites. Polyticks, mini blood-sucking parasites. They don't contribute to the body. They just suck the blood out of its victim. Most governments actually are just criminal enterprises. They steal from people. When you hear that's government-funded, remember, they first took the money from you. They're not giving their own money into this. They can take our electricity, but they will never take our braai. The voice of resistance in South Africa. Now, people talk about climate change. They've shown pictures that Victoria Falls is running dry. Well, it's actually a seasonal thing. If you go in the rainy season, like from January through April, May, yes, it's pouring. Even into July when things are getting quite brown around the side. But by the time you get then November, it's very dry. And okay, they can take picture of that, that it's dry. Of course, there's still water flowing on the sides. Even in December when it's at its lowest, it'll still be flowing a little bit, obviously. But you could take, because it's a full mile wide, you can take pictures of huge sections, even pan the camera and make it look like there's no water flowing from Victoria Falls. But this is climate change nonsense. And of course, you know who's not man of the year? Who's him person of the year or whatever it is now, because we don't want to presume on gender. But the kind of person or whatever of the year of Slime magazine. I didn't know people were still reading Time magazine. Oh, yeah. She's been warning about all these different things, and it gets colder when she's talking about global warming. How dare you?
Yeah, but she flew with an airplane to America, not that boat, because the boat was
seaworthy. Exactly. Right. No, I mean, who knows how much carbon footprint she's put behind.
All she wants is free Fridays that nobody goes to sport. That's what she wants.
Total child abuse. Her speeches don't. She's not a scientist.
Your parents are actors.
Yeah. Yes. Well, not very good ones. But anyway, so all this to say, warning you're entering a politically incorrect zone. Over here in the Reformation Society, people encounter free speech, which I know is now a thought crime. But let me tell you about some of the upcoming things. Our Biblical Worldview Summit is not that far away. 3rd to the 9th of January, this is our premier Biblical Worldview training program of the year. And it's not age-restricted. While it's focused primarily on people in high school and going into university and those in university, it's wide open and we get people of a wide diversion of ages. I think that we've got, with General Mulder, someone in his 70s, mid-70s, late 70s. And Reverend Croft, yes, no, he's quite a character. Converted from communism, Black Panther, drug dealer, gangster, convert to Christ. He's got quite a testimony. And he's coming back this year as well. So, Biblical Worldview Summit, we've got Colonel John Eidsmo, top journalist, soldier, a jurist, I should say. He's an attorney. He's a chaplain in the U.S. Air Force. Top-class chap who's written quite a lot of the books that are on our shelves over there, too. So we've got 13 speakers, lots of action, and every afternoon is practicals and sports and obstacle crossing team-building type things. And there'll be some outreaches into Hermanus as well. And then there's the Great Commission course, which used the BWS as its first week, but second phase starts with the second, third week, and we do get to the top of Table Mountain while we're about it. And we come down at night. So, those are some of the upcomings. Do pray for them. It's important to put feet to our faith. We always start a year off with a serious bang with our feet on the ground. And towards the end of January, we'll be having the March for Life, National Day of Repentance. Go to Parliament, stand outside Parliament, pray and protest. And following that will be Sanctity Life Sunday, when we're trying to persuade the pastors of this country to preach on what the Bible teaches and when life begins and what our responsibility is to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, to rescue those being led away to death, hold back those staggering towards slaughter. Who will rise up for me against the wicked? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? So whatever you can do on social media, personally, letters, one way or the other, telephone calls, whatever, to try and promote, to either get people to the Biblical Worldview Summit, get people to the Great Commission course, or involved in the life chain coming up next year. There's no harm. Some people, if only I'd known, give me warning. Well, here we're giving people a year's warning. And of upcoming, we do these things every year, first Sunday in October. And that's an opportunity to make a stand for life. Well, those are some announcements, observations, upcoming events. Freedom Betrayed is one of the most important books I've read. Herbert Hoover's Secret History of the Second World War and its Aftermath. The news, which for some reason the lamestream media is not reporting on. This is one of the most landmark books ever, and most media is ignoring it. Herbert Hoover was the 31st president of the United States. He is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He saved the lives of hundreds of thousands, even millions of people, with his food support campaigns during the First and Second World War and its aftermath. He was the campaigner for the people in Finland when they were being invaded by the Soviets. He's a major activist, and the fact that people can ignore him is interesting. But let me say something by way of introduction to why we're getting onto this. I was at Summit Ministries. In fact, for over 20 years, I was a regular guest speaker every year. Dr. David Noble, who founded Summit Ministries something like 60 years ago, invited me, and they would have every summer 7 to 8 sessions, 2 weeks at a time, and they up there in the summit, and I'd be the guest speaker at 1, 2, or even 3 of those sessions in an average summer. And then we launched the summit over here. Well, we found most people weren't willing to come to a 2-week program, so that's why we moved it to 1 week, and some people couldn't even handle that. So we moved down to 4 or 5 days, and we've been growing. Now it's up to 7 days. And so that's why our summits each year is different, because effectively you've got to go to 2 year sessions to get a normal summit session, which is meant to be 2 weeks anyway. So David Noble, who's a board member of ours and been a very good friend, he's now retired from Summit Ministries, but while he was there, he had me as a regular guest speaker on staff. So we were at one of these meetings, and somebody was saying, Obama's the worst president in the history of America. And I made the comment, I said, well, he's only been in office 2 years. It may turn out that he's won the worst, but I said, can I draw your attention to Jimmy Carter, who in 4 years of his worthless existence in the White House betrayed 14 countries to communism, including my own home country, Rhodesia. And Rhodesia is still suffering under the after effects of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy. He betrayed Nicaragua to communism, the Sandinistas. He betrayed Iran under the Shah, which was one of America's most reliable allies, into the hands of the Ayatollah crazies. And 39 years later, the people in Iran are still suffering, well, 40 years later, actually, the effects of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy betraying the allies. While I was talking, and of course, some people said, well, what about Bill Clinton? Well, here's Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. You can kind of tell, well, you know, Jimmy Carter was quite an inspiration for Bill Clinton, one of the lowest life forms to inhabit high office. And you kind of just get the impression of narcissism here. Is this not Bill Clinton all the way? So, okay, Obama's a bad president. But I just said, well, what about Jimmy Carter? And while I was talking, from the back of the hall, David Noble shouted out, Peter, you're wrong. When David Noble speaks, you want to listen? He said, if you're talking about damage, the worst president of the United States of America has got to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He betrayed 1/3 of the world's population into the hands of communism. Now, there was this long silence. We all had to just absorb this for a moment, because FDR has been portrayed as a great hero. He saved the free world and all of that. And yet, to think about this now, I'm talking about over 10 years ago. No, this is more like 12 years ago. There's David Noble challenging me over the fact that FDR is the worst president in American history. Now, bear in mind, David Noble's an American, and he's got the American flag flying above the summit building. He's a very serious patriot. So he's not being unpatriotic and acknowledging that one of America's most famous presidents, who was in the White House longer than anyone else, they just kept re-electing. In fact, the reason why America's got a term limitation that you're not allowed to be elected more than twice is because of FDR. FDR was so bad that they enacted legislation restricting that nobody may be elected more than twice. Two-term presidents, because they realized the longer they're in, the more corrupt they get. And so they had to have the safety of them. He's the reason why they've got a two-term limit. Okay, well, why are we dealing with FDR? Well, that's Herbert Hoover's number one focus. His book is a 900-page documentation that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. He did more damage to the world than anybody else. Now, that's not my opinion. That's the opinion of Herbert Hoover, the 31st president of the United States of America. How many of you have seen Dark Knight film? Quite a lot of you, I'm sure. Do you recall a character called Harvey Dent? Okay, I only saw this film once, but from my memory, Harvey Dent was the hero. He was the public prosecutor, was he? He was the one who's fighting crime, and it turned out that when he died, they blamed Batman for his death, and Batman took the blame that Harvey Dent was a hero and let himself be blamed. But Harvey Dent was actually the villain. Harvey Dent was evil. He was two-faced. And so in the interest of not hurting the people with the truth, Batman chose to take the blame and to go with the lie that Harvey Dent died for peace and justice and freedom, and he is the hero of the community. And the community built a cult around Harvey Dent. Those who've seen the film more often than me, can you agree that's a fair reflection of the film's message? Gotham City got evil, more evil, because you cannot believe a lie without serious negative consequences. Lies bring bondage. When you idolize evil, like Stalin, or Mandela, or Mao Zedong, or Vladimir Lenin, whether you're worshipping Winston Churchill, Mandela, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the result is a corruption of the entire society. If you can glorify and glamorize adulterers, liars, thieves, murderers, then the entire society is going to be affected. Just think in South Africa, they idolized Nelson Mandela. And so adultery has become perfectly acceptable because, well, Mandela did it, so it's got to be okay. And stone throwing's got to be fine. I mean, he did that. Petrol bombing's fine. Burning of vehicles, why not? I mean, Operation Maya Biu, Umkhonto we Sizwe, he organized the armed struggle. He launched it. The car bombs, incinerating some grandmother and a granddaughter in Joburg Station with a petrol bomb in the case. I mean, why not? If this is what Madiba did and he's glamorized as a hero, then what's wrong with us doing it? And so in the last 11 months, 1,400 Pentechnicon 18-wheel delivery trucks have been looted and burned at a cost of 1.4 billion rand. And more than half of the railway carriages in Cape Town municipality have been burned out in the last 3 years. And we can continue. This is the consequence of worshipping something that's evil. And in Dark Knight, although I realize Dark Knight's not scripture, it's just a fiction film, but you get a picture there, a story where there's a negative consequence from glamorizing and idolizing that which is not worthy of our respect. So, that by way of introduction, let's get to Freedom Betrayed. No. No, I think Ish comes organizing 50 Shades of Darkness. When you go to the cinemas, they actually say 50 Shades of Darkness brought to you by Ishcom. And so, yeah, okay. So, these are some reviews of the Freedom Betrayed book by Herbert Hoover. Forbes magazine editor Tim Ferguson says, Freedom Betrayed is an extended excoriation of Franklin D. Roosevelt and his foreign policy. The words will be jarring to many who today regard World War II in uniformly heroic terms. In other words, if you believe the politically correct World War II, rah, rah, yay, we saved the world. That's why everything's going so swimmingly great since 1945. And, you know, things couldn't be better because we were saved. I mean, imagine if they hadn't fought for freedom in the Second World War, how terrible life could be for us now and so on. So obviously, when you suddenly hear what he's got to say about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Second World War, it will be jarring to those who watch Hollywood propaganda. One of the author's provocative questions includes, what part did communist agents in the United States government positions play in Roosevelt's policies? Do you know Franklin Delano Roosevelt was married to a card-carrying communist? Eleanor Roosevelt was an open communist. Franklin Delano Roosevelt called one of his college buddies, who was the head of OSS, the Office of Secret Service, the forerunner to the CIA, Wild Bill Donovan, open communist. Wild Bill Donovan, during the Second World War, did everything he could to see that the communists got all the aid. Like in Yugoslavia, they made sure all the aid went to Tito's partisans, the Red Star commies, who oppressed the poor people of Yugoslavia for the next 45 years. Nothing went to the royalist, monarchist, conservative, the actual government of Yugoslavia. It all went to the partisans who were communists and so on. And it did the same thing in China. All aid went to the communist Chinese of Mao Zedong, who weren't even fighting the Japanese, mind you. They were keeping themselves out of it, instead of to Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist, who was the real leader of the country and so on. And so they betrayed place after place. They betrayed the conservatives and the Christians, and they supported the communists. And that was because Franklin Delano Roosevelt chose a communist to head up the OSS, which was the forerunner for the CIA. He put a communist, Alger Hiss, in charge of the United Nations. 1943, UN first met in San Francisco. Alger Hiss, a known KGB agent, was the first general secretary of it. And head of the International Monetary Fund, also communist agent. Dexter White and a whole lot of others. He was surrounded by communists. Virtually every major position in the War Department, the State Department, the Agricultural Department, wherever you wanted, under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he had communists right, left, and center. That's why Stalin had all the secrets about the American atomic bomb project about as soon as the Americans had it. Because the entire Manhattan Project was saturated with communists. The culmination of an extraordinary literary project that Herbert Hoover launched during World War II, his magnus opus, is now at last published 50 years after its completion. Now, you may wonder, why only now? Well, Herbert Hoover was a meticulous, footnote everything, double, quadruple check. He had 8 secretaries just double checking all the facts and getting down all the footnotes and making sure everything was right and checking with all the experts. He was not going to do something winging it. He was absolutely methodical. And so the government of America, including people like Eisenhower and Truman, would regularly give him tasks, you know, to go on a foreign diplomatic this and that and investigate this and other issues in order to get him off the track of his book. And so it took him over 20 years to produce this book. And in 1963, he's ready to publish it. And he dies in this hotel room in New York City, very unexpectedly and suspiciously, I would say. And then in come the heavies from the CIA and so on, and they seize all his books and everything and intimidate his children and relatives not to publish his book in the interest of national security, that this book will damage national security, will actually destroy the Democratic Party. It would have shown that the Democratic Party had been completely and utterly riddled by communists from the from 1913, actually, right back from the time of Woodrow Wilson. And the Democratic Party led America to the most disastrous wars of the 20th century. First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War. That's all Democratic Party activities. And, of course, the Democratic Party dropped the atom bombs and so on. So the Democratic Party would have been destroyed by the revelations that Herbert Hoover had in this book. And so they sealed this book for 50 years, half a century. And when George Nash finally managed to get to the documents after they were unsealed after 50 years, and publish it. Well, of course, most of the people that this book excoriates are now dead. And so America's got through their Cold War and all the rest of it. And so they now think it's probably okay to bring it out. And the mass media's ignored it. Freedom Betrayed offers a revisionist re-examination of the World War and the Cold War aftermath. And it's a sweeping indictment of the lost statesmanship of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the best friend or useful idiot the communists ever had. Freedom Betrayed, Herbert Hoover's Secret History of the Second World War and its Aftermath, originated as a volume of Hoover's memoirs, a book initially focused on his battle against President Roosevelt's foreign policies before Pearl Harbor. As FDR said, presidents are selected, not elected. And he was an ultimate insider, serious insider. He was, as you can see from the kind of way he has a cigarette in his mouth and all that. This chap, he was in with the deep state. As time went on and events unfolded, however, Herbert Hoover widened the scope to include Roosevelt's disastrous foreign policies during the war, as well as the war's consequences, the expansion of the Soviet Empire at war's end and eruption of the Cold War. Sell out to Stalin. And this book says the tragic errors of Churchill and Roosevelt. Well, Herbert Hoover disagrees that there weren't tragic errors. It was treason. It was knowing, treacherous, selling out of allies, betraying their principles, violating laws and constitution and common sense. It wasn't a tragic error at all. And he documents it. On issue after issue, Herbert Hoover raises crucial questions that continue to be debated today. Did Franklin Roosevelt deceitfully maneuver the United States into an undeclared war, an unconstitutional naval war, with Germany even before 1941? Answer, yes, he did. He ordered full mobilization. He had American factories that would have been turning out refrigerators and cars and so on, turning out trucks and tanks to go to the Soviet Union long before America was involved in the war. America was secretly involved in the war. Now, to give the background to this, after the First World War, which Woodrow Wilson dragged the Americans into, the American people were 85% against intervention in the wars. Remember, America's founding father, George Washington, said, never get involved in Europe's wars. Never get involved in entangling alliances. Maintain isolation from the wars of Europe and the rest of the world. America should defend its own borders and nothing else. And that was the founding president's warnings to the people. And many, like Teddy Roosevelt, had followed that. But now Franklin Delano Roosevelt's a totally different type of person. Woodrow Wilson promised in the 1916 elections not to send America to warn him. One of his campaigns was he kept us out of the war. And the moment he got reelected, he got them into the war. But Woodrow Wilson was already supplying Britain and France with weaponry before America got in the war. They were already effectively involved. So 1920, after the First World War, the Americans were convinced overwhelmingly. They'd been tricked. They'd been duped by Woodrow Wilson and the British to getting involved in the First World War for no good reason. 100,000 Americans had died in the First World War for no reason at all, except to add a million square miles to the British and French empires and steal a whole lot of people's real estate, including their private farms and homes and so on in Southwest Africa, Tanzania, and so on. So the Americans were very, very angry. And the American had such a backlash that the 1920 elections, they voted the Democrats out of the White House, out of the Senate, out of the House of Representatives, and the Republicans took over and brought in sweeping legislation, making it thoroughly illegal for any American of any department or rank from the president down to ever again get involved in a foreign war. And they brought in tight legislation. We cannot sell bombs, bullets, any weapons, any offensive weapons to belligerents or anyone involved in the war or about to get involved in the war. You cannot send American troops overseas for these wars and so on and so forth. So what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was doing was completely and utterly illegal. It was jail time treason in accordance with America's laws at that time. And there were people campaigning like President Herbert Hoover and Charles Lindbergh, the great hero who first flew solo across the Atlantic, under the campaign America First. Now, Charles Lindbergh's father had been a senator in the First World War, and he had started the America First campaign. In other words, get us out of the war, don't get involved in the war, and stay out of the war, and so on. Now, his son resuscitated America First. And it was interesting that in his election campaign, Donald Trump was using the term America First. Many people heard he was appealing to that voter base that doesn't want foreign wars. And he even was using terminology, no more useless foreign wars, bring the troops home, defend our own borders, which, of course, was a brilliant idea if they'd only done it. So Herbert Hoover documents that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was doing what Woodrow Wilson did in a violation of the laws of America. He was ordering the American Navy not only to supply Britain with vast amounts of weapons, but to supply the Soviet Union with vast amounts of weapons long before Pearl Harbor, and ordering them to shoot on sight any German naval vessels, submarines and others. So they had already declared war on Germany by action, although not by diplomacy. Another question, did he unnecessarily appease Joseph Stalin at the pivotal Tehran conference in 1943? Yes, he did. Did communist agents and sympathizers in the White House, Department of State, Department of the Treasury play malign, in other words, malicious roles in America's wartime decisions? Yes, they did. There were KGB agents. There's a whole book on it. Stalin's secret agents, the subversion of Roosevelt's government. Roosevelt had communists running everything. You know, when you've got Wild Bill Donovan organizing the OSS, no wonder they murdered America's greatest wartime combat general, George Patton, at the end of the Second World War, because he had a communist running the OSS. Wild Bill Donovan, as we've proven and documented in previous presentations on that. Hoover raises numerous arguments that challenge us to think again about our past. Whether or not you ultimately accept all his arguments or not, the exercise of confronting them will be very worthwhile. Herbert Hoover's Freedom Betrayed is a monumentally well-documented historic indictment of U.S. foreign policy. And by the way, I've got it here. This is a doorstopper. You can drop it on a liberal's foot and make him limp. It is. Here's what the Washington Times says. James Pearson of the Washington Times, a remarkably well-researched, heavily footnoted revisionist history, seems destined to become one of the key historic documents of the mid-20th century, challenging many long-accepted interpretations of events. That's what it should be doing. But is this being discussed in political science and history departments in U.S. universities? It should be. Is this being discussed on media? It should be forcing those people in Hollywood who make films on inspired by true events, and you know, some of this might have actually happened. The names in the place are true. Only the facts have been changed to protect the guilty and demonize the innocent. But, you know, basically it's inspired by something that might have happened sometime, although we've changed everything else. You'd think that this book would inspire a whole lot of new films, looking at things from the deceitful treachery and treason of Roosevelt's government, but not yet. Pat Buchanan, who was Ronald Reagan's scriptwriter, historian, researcher, and also a candidate for presidency as well, Pat Buchanan wrote, "Freedom Betrayed is a searing indictment of FDR and the men around him as politicians who lied prodigiously," means basically all the time, "about their desire to keep America out of war, even as it took one deliberate step after another to take us into war." You see, the Americans love this image of the reluctant warrior. I mean, you see it in, for example, The Patriot. No, I don't want to go to war. No, on and on. And he's forced to. That's the way the Americans like to say, you know, I didn't want to pick a fight, but, you know, I'll end it. This kind of thing. I got forced into it against my will. So the reluctant warrior is such a cliche. You get it in virtually every American film. It's the total reluctant warrior is absolutely forced against all his, and he still wins. So this is what Pat Buchanan says about Freedom Betrayed. Tom Bethel in the American Spectator writes, "In its sharp descent from conventional understanding of the mid-20th century, Herbert Hoover's book succeeds in bringing that history back to life and in forcing us to think about it in ways that will surely be unfamiliar to many." Very unfamiliar. In fact, a lot of people think, that can't be true. I mean, I saw Pearl Harbor film, and FDR seemed like a nice guy in that film. Of course, that was an actor, you know. Gerald Rossello wrote for the University Bookman, "Freedom Betrayed the work of a serious student of history, and it's heavily researched and footnoted. Its publication is a monumental moment in the history of presidential writings, and Nash deserves credit for his persistence and dedication in shaping it 50 years after it was sealed." That does require persistence and courage, actually. In the Reagan Diaries, the editor of Reagan Diaries, Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at Rice University, says, "What an amazing historic find. Historian George Nash, the dean of Herbert Hoover Studies, has brought forth a very rare manuscript in Freedom Betrayed. Here's Hoover unplugged, delineating on everything from the lost statesmanship of FDR to the Korean War. A truly invaluable work of presidential history, highly recommended." Don't expect too many professors of history to listen to him on that, though. "Finally, after waiting for close to half a century, we now have Hoover's massive and impassioned account of American foreign policy from 1933 to the early 1950s. Thanks to the efforts of George Nash, there exists an unparalleled picture of Herbert Hoover's worldview, one long shared by many conservatives. Nash's thorough and perceptive introduction shows why he remains America's leading Hoover scholar." Now, this from Justice Doniger, author of Storm and Horizon, Challenge to American Interventionism. "A forcefully argued and well-documented alternative to and critique of the conventional liberal historic narrative of America's road to war and its war aims." Now, we didn't want to go to war. We were forced to go to war. And our only goal was to give freedom to everyone else, unselfishly. We're not getting anything out of it. "Even readers comfortable with the established account will find themselves thinking that the accepted history should be reconsidered and perhaps revised." That's from J. John Earl Haynes, author of Spies, The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America. These are pretty serious reviews. Freedom Betrayed offers vivid proof of William Faulkner's famous dictum that the past is never dead. In fact, it's not even past. Past is still with us and it affects our present. For those who might think that history has settled the mantle of consensus around the events of World War II era, Hoover's iconoclastic, you know what iconoclasm is? It's when you smash idols. Iconoclast is the people who literally, in the Reformation, they went and they smashed idols of Mary and other saints and so on. So an iconoclast, he takes his iron rod and he smashes the idols of Winston Churchill and Stalin and Lenin and, of course, FDR mainly. It'll come as an unsettling reminder that much controversy remains, but turns quirky and astute in prose that is often acerbic, that means acidic, and unfailingly provocative. Hoover opens some old wounds and inflicts a few new wounds of his own while assembling a passionate case for the tragic errors of Franklin Roosevelt's diplomacy. This is a serious book that should be read by anyone who wants to understand 20th century history. And that's from David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University. He says, Freedom Betrayed is a must read for anyone interested in the most consequential upheaval 20th century. There's no more important event that shaped the 20th century than the Second World War. With the possible exception of the First, but of course the First and Second are so related. Herbert Hoover's Freedom Betrayed is a bracing work of historic revisionism that takes aim at U.S. foreign policy under President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Part memoir, part diplomatic history, Hoover's magnum opus seeks to expose the lost statesmanship that in Hoover's eyes needlessly drew the United States into the Second World War and in its aftermath facilitated the rise to global power of the ideological rival, the Soviet Union. Freedom Betrayed, as George Nash asserts in his astute and authoritative introduction, resembles a prosecutor's brief against Roosevelt and against Winston Churchill as well at the bar of history. Thanks to Nash's impressive feat of reconstruction, Hoover's thunderbolt now strikes. Nearly half a century after it was readied, the president's interpretation of the conduct and consequences of the Second World War may not entirely persuade most readers who've been brainwashed for decades. Yet, as Nash testifies, like the best kind of revisionist history, Freedom Betrayed challenges us to think afresh about our past. Now this, from Bernard Pettenord, author of A Wealth of Ideas, Revelations from the Hoover Institute Archives. The United Nations was formed to defeat Germany. The United Nations fight for freedom, they say. But then what's the Soviet Union's flag doing up there? You notice our flag, the South African flags, as part of this too. We were also part of that United Nations assembled to defeat and destroy Germany, the biggest obstacle to communism advancing in Europe. And the man who's the General Secretary of the United Nations, Olga Hiss, KGB agent. Indictment of US foreign policy. Here you can see the United Nations fights for freedom, but why is the Soviet flag right out front there? The American flag might be the highest. But, oh, there's the South African flag again. Novel. Brazil's there, Taiwan's there, goodness me, New Zealand even, Mexico, goodness me, they're all there, Australia. So the Soviet Union's one sticking out a bit more. The United Nations fights for freedom. Freedom? Now, I must admit, I grew up believing this junk. But when I became a missionary to Eastern Europe and I was going in with Bill Bathman, Poland, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Albania, went to all those countries with Bill Bathman, I heard a different story. The people in Eastern Europe, we're talking about back in the 80s, they're behind the Iron Curtain being oppressed. What freedom? You never gave us freedom. You betrayed us. What do you mean we betrayed you? Well, you English and Americans, you betrayed us. We didn't betray you. We never got any freedom. And then they start talking about Yalta. To my shame, I didn't know much about Yalta. I didn't know much. I just heard that we had freed the world, saved the world, and all of that stuff. I mean, you know, we watched the Dam Busters and the Battle of Britain, and we thought we knew what had happened. We'd been given a standard history, but then you get on the ground where the people in Eastern Europe had suffered the consequences. Even President George Bush Jr. had to apologize when he went to Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia that they were betrayed by America. I mean, even American president had to admit that he couldn't go there and get otherwise. I mean, they were going to have his throat out if he didn't admit that. The people in Eastern Europe, still, it hurts. They've lost lots of family members to the Soviet Union, the KGB. So they're not going to believe this junk that comes out from our Hollywood nonsense and our self-serving legends and propaganda idolatry of how we saved the world, when they know that the world was immensely worse afterwards. And communism was saved by the Second World War and American intervention, and South African gold, by the way. Brilliantly edited by George Nash, Freedom Betrayed is as passionate as it is provocative. Many no doubt will dispute Hoover's strategic vision, but few can dispute the historic significance of this unique volume, published even as Americans of the 21st century debate their moral and military obligations. This from scholar in residence at George Mason University. So these are pretty serious people all singing the praises of Freedom Betrayed. So why have most people not heard of it? 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6 to 11 says, "Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they're written for admonition." Now, here, 1 Corinthians 10 speaking to us about the importance of history in general. Of course, the history of Israel primarily, but the history of how God deals with nations, and history is important. History is important that we learn from evil so that we don't fall for it again and deceptions. So, what exactly does Herbert Hoover's secret history of the Second World War and its aftermath declare? Herbert Hoover was the author of more than 30 books, the founder of the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, Peace at Stanford University. He's a strong advocate for not getting involved in foreign wars. He advocated a Swiss type of neutrality, armed neutrality, where you protect your own, but you don't interfere with others. He was a respected man in his time. This is his birthplace, humble origins. First picture of Herbert Hoover, age 3, at the time he entered Stanford University. This would be with his wife and their youngest son and more children. So, the making of the great humanitarian. Herbert Hoover was known as the great humanitarian. He came to attention of the world during the First World War in his concern for the victims of the hunger blockade, the British naval hunger blockade, which was starving people not only in Germany and Austria, but also in Belgium. And so he was mobilizing food against the British blockade to be able to break the blockade, going through neutral countries like Switzerland to help the people, and Sweden, to get aid to the people who were starving. He was a person who was concerned for the poor. And his family, 2 sons and daughter-in-law, and his wife. Of course, he campaigned for president. It was his great misfortune that when he came to power, a Republican, came to power against the Democratic candidate. You know, in America at that stage, because telecommunications weren't as advanced, you waited several more months before, after election in November, to when he became president. So president wasn't installed in January, as they are now. They were installed in March. 1 week after he is installed as president of America, the Wall Street crash, which was obviously engineered, occurred. So his presidency was doomed because you can't survive an economic crash. And of course, economic crash have got nothing to do with the presidents. It's everything to do with the bankers. But it was engineered. Of course, it made billions for the Rothschilds and Rockefellers and so on, but it destroyed his administration. So he could only be a one-term president because whoever was coming up the next time would win. Whoever is present at a time of an economic crash and their party will lose the next election. It's just a fact. That's the way it works. And so, although he couldn't have possibly been to blame for the Wall Street crash, his presidency was finished, basically, before it had even begun. "Being a politician is a poor profession," he said. "Being a public servant is a noble profession." Now, this is a man who really was not a politician as much as a statesman. 31st president of the United States of America, and a God-fearing man, we might say. But nevertheless, okay, so some of the Herbert Hoover background. Here's the crash of 1929. He had just become president that week, and economic chaos occurs. And of course, while it's a disaster for millions of people, about 6 million farmers lost their farms. Dust Bowl, destruction, disaster. And yet, some people made billions. I mean, there's the Rothschilds and Rockefellers came out of it very well. Well, you can imagine he's wondering why all this happened, and he must have started digging. Herbert Hoover was an internationally acclaimed humanitarian who literally saved millions of lives with his food relief programs during and after the First World War and during the Second World War and its aftermath. Here he's appealing for aid for the people suffering in Poland in 1939. Can anyone identify this place or time? This is the parliament in Finland in Helsinki being bombed by the Soviets in the Winter War, 1939. Most people don't even know about that. Finland was a democracy. And Finland was an ally of Germany. And Finland was being attacked by the Soviets. And the Allies didn't want to help them. And they damned them to help because they were allied to Germany. But the fact is that they were a democratically elected government that hated communism. And managed to defeat the Soviets in the Winter War and save their country. But they were starving. And Herbert Hoover was about the only person in America who seemed to really care from a leadership point of view. And so he organized massive campaigns to help Finland and to raise money for the Finns in their war against the Soviets. His government wouldn't do anything to help them, but he as an individual at least would. And he brought out this book in 1942 called The Problems of Lasting Peace and put, these are some of the ads and newspapers, on basically warning about this interventionism, getting involved in these foreign wars. So here in 1946, he's disembarking from a military transport plane during an international food relief mission. Here he's caring for children starving in Poland, immediately after the war, visiting devastated cities of Germany after the war, the ruins, caring for war orphans, and traveling throughout. He's very involved. So, when the war closed, we were challenged with a peacetime choice between the American system of rugged individualism and a European philosophy of diametrically opposed doctrines, doctrines of paternalism and state socialism. It's a tragedy that his book, Freedom Betrayed, was not published during his own lifetime. It would have destroyed any chance of continued communist infiltration of American politics as he exposed how the Democratic Party was a totally compromised institution. This invaluable historic analysis is of immense significance for anyone wanting to understand the pivotal events of the 20th century, which is the Second World War. Imagine spending 20 years writing and rewriting a monumental tome dissecting 20th century global conflicts, only to have it suppressed and sit in storage for nearly five more decades. Such was the fate of the book Herbert Hoover called his magnum opus, a heavily documented effort to expose hidden aspects of U.S. foreign policy before, during, and after the Second World War. This is his living room suite in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, where he died, suddenly and surprisingly. Before he could bring his book to print, he suddenly died and was given all the honors that they do, even to people that the government has murdered, like they did to General Patton, or for that matter, President Kennedy. And his cottage and gravesite, again, a humble choice. After being suppressed for half a century, Herbert Hoover's book is now in print, available, shattering prevailing myths, exposing shocking treachery at the highest levels, meaning right up to Roosevelt. The manuscript that America's 31st president completed in 1963 is now in print. Edited by George Nash, the 900-page memoir offers an encyclopedia of uncomfortable truths that seriously challenge all the traditional views of U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Do you know, for example, here he is meeting with the so-called King of Saudi Arabia, who's nothing but a desert bandit. I mean, King...
Sand pirate.
That's about the best term you can use. Absolute murderers, thieves, and criminals. And he poured in the aid to Saudi Arabia. He helped build up modern Saudi Arabia. And here's British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And I mean, it looks like there's a love relationship going there. Do you know, at this very moment, at this moment, old Winston Churchill asked Stalin, can you forgive me for the things I said about you in the past? because he used to refer to Bolshevism as a plague bacillus, a new bubonic plague, the greatest threat to the world, all before he went bankrupt and needed Jewish bankers to bail him out in 1936. And then he went from communism was the greatest threat to the world to National Socialism was the greatest threat to the world. Never said another bad word against communism after that. So when he said to Joseph Stalin, "Can you forgive me?" Do you know what Stalin's response was? "It's not mine to forgive, it's God's to forgive." I mean, it's atheist communist. By the way, how many people know that Joseph Stalin was once a theological student? Sadly so. That unfortunately is true. An apostate is always worse than just a straight atheist. Herbert Hoover engaged in thorough investigation for over 20 years, examining all the evidence, personally meeting with world leaders around the continents. He had access to everyone, from Truman, and here with President Wilhelm Miklas of Austria, 1938. Here meeting with Adolf Hitler in 1938. Here meeting with President Ignaz Masaryk of Poland, 1938. Here with President Kossuth Kallio of Finland in Helsinki, 1938. Meeting with Pope Pius XII to discuss food problems in Europe in 1946. Here meeting with Gandhi in India, 1946. Here meeting with General Douglas MacArthur in Tokyo, 1946. Harry Truman conferring about the European food program. So this is a man who had access to some of the leading people in the world. Herbert Hoover came to conclusions that the United States alliance with the Soviet Union and the Second World War was the worst thing that could happen to civilization. The worst thing that could happen to civilization. But we are told over and over in our history books and movie screens, it's the best thing they've had. The Good War. By the way, who called it the Good War? Who called it the Good War? A drug-taking, pedophile, rapist, blasphemer, antichrist pervert in Hollywood came up with the term the Good War. And you've got people talking about America's greatest generation. That's also from same pedophile, antichrist, blaspheming, pagan in Hollywood term. The greatest generation. How is the Second World War generation the greatest generation? The generation that legalized abortion, pornography, homosexuality, kicked the Bible out of schools, kicked the Ten Commandments out of schools, they're the greatest generation? What happened to the pioneers, the reformers, the explorers? And there's so many other generations to think about. But the generation that betrayed freedom into the hands of the Soviet Union is the greatest generation. The generation that didn't care about the kids going to hell in a handbasket. And you just think of everything that's happened. The children of the parents who came out of the Second World War, the so-called greatest generation, were the hippies of Woodstock, were the drug takers of the hippie culture and the Woodstock generation, and well, they produced people like Clinton. Clinton was one of those hippies who was brought up by that greatest generation, so-called. I call it the worst generation. Roosevelt had engineered the United States' entry into World War II despite public and congressional anti-war sentiment. According, now Herbert Hoover was super suspicious over this. He said, when Britain gave a war guarantee to Poland, he sat up and said, this has never happened in the history of the world before. This is the dumbest thing ever to be done in history. He said, Britain has never been an ally of Poland before. They've never given a war guarantee to anyone before. Why now? Why there? And Poland, which had a very similar government to Germany in 1939, and they had the same kind of military-type dictator with a National Socialist kind of ideology as well, who was dressed in the same kind of uniform with the same kind of moustache. That's why you never see a picture of him. But so the Americans talking about fighting for freedom in Poland. Well, Poland didn't have freedom. But Poland was actually a dictatorship. But that's, you know, who cares? So Poland, who was actually between the Soviet Union and Germany, you're going to have to make peace with one of them because you're between a rock and a hard place, between Scylla and Charybdis, the devil and deep blue sea, however you want to put it. It's like the Nederlanders, when they were between France and Germany, they said, let's take the sea. And so they extended the country into the ocean because they thought fighting the sea was more intelligent than fighting Germany or France. And Poland, who was already an enemy of the Soviet Union, having fought them in the 1920s, why would they want to make an enemy of Germany? All Germany wanted was Danzig back, which was 95% German. It was German territory. It had always been German for centuries. And why did Poland not give it back? Because Germany was offering all kinds of massive economic benefits for doing so. There was no reason to. Why did France suddenly get involved in alliance with Poland? So Herbert Hoover is scratching his head saying, this doesn't make sense. Well, he did the investigation. He found out the details. It's not that America was minding their own business and got dragged into the war by Britain. It was exactly the opposite. Herbert Hoover documents in this book that the U.S. war, that the Second World War started with U.S. foreign policy. It started from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who bribed, cajoled, lied to, gave false promises to Poland to stop them from giving Danzig back to Germany. He lied, cajoled, and persuaded and bribed the British and French to give a war guarantee to Poland. It was not an interest to Poland. Nobody lifted a finger to help Poland during the war, and they certainly didn't do anything after the war, and they just betrayed them to the Soviet Union, who crushed them, murdered the entire leadership of the country in the Katyn Forest Massacre and so on. So the Poles didn't benefit from this. Britain didn't benefit from it. In fact, Britain lost its empire as a result of the Second World War. And France, well, it didn't do them any good. They went from being a superpower to being, you know, from hero to zero in, what, like 6 weeks? The greatest military power in the world, France fancied themselves, thinking they were, you know, the heirs of Napoleon. They were wiped out by the Germans in 6 weeks, just finished. Unthinkable. So there was no reason for it. And Herbert Hoover discovered the American government of Franklin Delano Roosevelt engineered the British, the French, and the Poles into war with Germany and sat in the sidelines. Well, they were funneling money, they were funneling weapons, well, not to Poland, but to Britain and France, for their own ends. I mean, remember, at the beginning of the First World War, Britain was the greatest economic military superpower in the world. America was like backwards. France was a greater empire than America. At the end of the First World War, America was on the up and Britain and France were on the way down. At the end of the Second World War, Britain and France were like kaput. And the United States and the Soviet Union were the new superpowers on the block, and Europe was prostrate at their feet, bombed into submission and occupied, either by the Soviets or by the Americans. And so Herbert Hoover looks at this and says, this is not the reluctant warrior who got dragged into the war. You were the initiators. You're the prime movers. This was engineered.
Some would say that's strategic.
Yes. This, in the face of his 1940 campaign. Now, this is Franklin Delano Roosevelt said in his campaign 1940. I've said this before, but I'll say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars. And in the author's view, the wise course would have been to let Stalin's Russia and Germany's Hitler destroy each other, as he put it. Because even whoever won that war would have been greatly weakened by it. And this is a colossal battle of titans. Now, for those people who have this view, as I had when I grew up, that Second World War was a war between England and Germany. Well, actually, if you look at the facts, England inflicted not even 4% of Germany's total military deaths in the whole Second World War. 90% of Germany's military deaths in the Second World War were on the Eastern Front. The Second World War, you know, if you think that the Second World War was all being fought in the Western Front, that was the sideshow. The main focus of the war was communism and nationalism, Stalin, Hitler, Eastern Front, Operation Barbarossa. That was the war. Everything else was distraction. It wasn't the main focus. You know, so this idea that, you know, England was in one side of the ring, Germany was the other side of the ring, and in a fair fight, the nothing like it. It's like getting all the gangs on the block together to attack at the same time. That's what it was like. It wasn't one-on-one. You know, this England versus Germany, like the football match in 1966. No, it wasn't like that. You've got 11 on your side, we've got 11 on our side, you know. It wasn't that way. American territory was never threatened by the Germans. And even Western Europe would have remained unscathed had not attempted to stop Germany's eastward push. This was the battle. Barbarossa, stretching across 3,000 kilometers to start with. It got more advanced, more to Russia. By partnering with Stalin to defeat Hitler, Roosevelt and Churchill gave communism legitimacy. I mean, this is the picture. The Soviet Union's ham and sickle, the British Union Jack, and the Stars and Stripes together, like they are some kind of moral equivalents. Herbert Hoover personally warned British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, 22nd of March 1938, another world war would probably destroy the British Empire, which was 100% accurate. Britain's involvement in a war must be avoided at all costs. Britain will lose its empire if it's engaged in another war. It had lost just about everything in the First World War anyway. It was tottering in 1938. It couldn't afford another world war. They were still in debt to America. They only paid off debts to America for the First World War a few years ago.
From then on, all the colonies became independent. They lost it.
Or worse. Yeah. Or trade. Herbert Hoover advised that if Germany could be given the freedom to rectify the injustice of the Versailles Treaty, there would be no threat to Western Europe. U.S. Secretary of State Lansing said the peace treaty that he and Woodrow Wilson brought home, the Versailles Treaty menaces the existence of civilization. The Versailles Treaty was the biggest problem that caused the Second World War. Micah 6 verse 8, he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. Proverbs 17:15. Hoover was convinced that Germany was looking eastward. The Germans are the most virile people in the continent, a land people, not a sea people, whose vision has been towards the east. If another Armageddon is coming, his hope was that it would come on the plains of Russia and not on the frontiers of France. Which makes sense. Western civilization will be infinitely better off if the Germans fight in the east instead of to the west. Why get in the way? It would be a disaster if the Western democracies were dragged down by war. The end result would be to save the cruel Soviet despotism in Russia. Now, these are all words of Herbert Hoover written in the 1930s, before the war. He was warning the people. He had access to the heads of state. He was speaking with them directly. But remember, while they promised him liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. Herbert Hoover sounded the alarm against Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, which was socialism, naked socialism, a dangerous collectivist assault on the traditional American system of ordered liberty. You see, FDR was able to, with his New Deal, he nationalized vast amounts of American, vast amounts of farms, and millions of farming families lost their homes and were put into work battalions, I think is the best term. They were literally regimented into building the big dams and named the one dam the Hoover Dam, which was a bit of a cheek, considering Herbert Hoover had nothing to do with it, but he was the most respected previous president. But this was an FDR New Deal thing. He just had these people marching off there with their shovels to build these great, big, massive state enterprises in exchange for food. People are impoverished, had nothing else. Hoover warned that one of the lessons from the Great War was the victors suffer almost equally with the vanquished in economic misery and spiritual degradation. He warned that in war, the resultant inflation confiscates the savings of all. The result of America going into another war would be increased despotism under a centralized, increasingly intrusive government at home. Has that not happened? Talk about intrusive government. He warned of the rise of dictatorships on both sides of the Atlantic and planned economies with increased government debts and deficits. It's never been worse, debt-wise and so on. Hoover, in public meetings and his writings before the Second World War, warned that Americans should harden their resolves to keep out of other people's wars, and we should convince Europe that this is our policy. We should have nothing to do with other people's wars. Hoover emphasized we must keep peace with dictatorships as well as with popular governments. It's not our business to interfere in other countries' affairs. The forms of government which other people pass through in working out their destinies is not our business. We can never herd the world into the paths of righteousness with the dogs of war. I mean, these are all Hoover's terms. And it's like you may not like what your neighbors do, but it's none of your business to walk over there and start lecturing your neighbors what they've got to do in their house or in their other country. He rejected FDR's schemes for preserving peace by waging war. Now, how's that for an oxymoron? And proposed that Americans rather mobilize the collective moral courses to prevent war. The greatest service that this nation can give to the future of humanity is to revitalize and purify our own democracy, insisting upon intellectual honesty and keep out of war. Well, wouldn't that be a relief and a fresh change if they had intellectual honesty and kept out of war? But every single war that America gets involved in is for peace and freedom. Yeah, I mean, they have just killed hundreds of thousands of people in the Middle East in a war against terror. Hundreds of thousands, possibly well over a million, have died in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria in the name of fighting terrorism. Well, what do you think those people whose children are getting incinerated by napalm or phosphorus bombs or being vaporized by these cruise missiles coming into their suburbs, what do you think they think about all this? Do you think this? They think, oh, yay, more freedom and democracy? No, it looks like terrorism to them. This is waged in the name of peace and freedom to fight terrorism. Hoover recommended that rectifying the injustice of the Treaty of Versailles was the best safeguard against war. It's true. If you'd only returned what had been stolen, there wouldn't be the motivation for the war. He insists that America itself has nothing militarily to fear. There's not the remotest chance that national defense will be challenged from abroad. I mean, here's just look at the picture. There's the Axis powers, Germany, Italy, Romania, Hungary. There they are, and Bulgaria. And there's Japan. There's the Soviet Union, China, Australia, Brazil. I mean, come on, seriously. These guys represent a threat to all of them. World domination is what America, France, and Britain had. But Germany is working for world domination. Without a four-engine bomber and without a single aircraft carrier, how's that going to work? The danger was from intellectual and economic collectivism. That's another word for socialism, which was corrupting America from within. America was suffering a moral regression in government. You can see it from 1933. There's no doubt that the moral regression that started under FDR, I must agree with Dr. David Noble. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's the worst president in American history. Oh, funny enough, when he said that, some after the shocked silence in this big hall, one person from the back shouted, "But it all started with Abraham Lincoln," which, you know, I must admit, that's also true. If you're talking about the worst presidents in American history, I put FDR at the top or the bottom, you know, depending which way you want to put this. You know, he's the worst. For the second, probably put Lincoln, actually.
Very similar.
Very, very similar. And by the way, there's an excellent lecture that you can get on Sermon Audio by George Grant. Lincoln and Lenin. Sermon Audio. Lincoln and Lenin. I don't think it's in writing. I've looked for it in writing, but it's a mystery. He gives us similarities in upbringing, background, temperament, and politics between Lincoln and Lenin. And they both waged wars for the Union against the South, which is true. In the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union being in civil war, they're fighting against the Southern whites, the ones who wanted freedom from the Soviet Union. And of course, in America, it's the Confederates. But it's same kind of, and the way they were idolized by their people and turned into state martyrs and everything else. Incredible.
The Americans never wanted to start any war because they learned their lesson from the Civil War.
Yes.
Not one side is winning. All sides were just losing.
This was a bad move.
Father against son, brother against brother, the one was
converted. Yes. So Americans were very anti-war. We've had another lecture on power propaganda because America launched one of the greatest propaganda offensives ever with the Committee for Public Information using Sigmund Freud's nephew to run that, and Edward Bernays. And they propagandized the American people from being 85% anti-war to being 85% pro-war in a matter of 2 years, using movies and marches and things like this. And at the end, Americans were so hyped up that they were killing German shepherds and German schnauzers and sausage dogs, lynching people, imprisoning Amish people because they were pacifists and didn't want to get involved in the war. shooting and hanging people, lynching people just for having German names or not wanting to be involved in the war with pacifists. Do you think they could have gone to that extent?
That happened in South Africa as well in the First World War.
Yes, it did.
Where I'm from in the Eastern Cape, very German influence up until the First World War, right? That whole part of the eastern half of the Eastern Cape around the Fish River,
yeah.
It's all German.
King Williamstown.
King Williamstown.
Berlin, Hanover.
All these places. And what actually happened is the German missionaries, that area was evangelized and mission German Lutheran missionaries and were basically founded that whole area, developed it and everything. And then what happened was First World War, very similar to a Southwest Africa sort of thing, these missionaries were literally through the propaganda driven
chased out.
They were literally chased out. Missionaries.
I've been
German
horrified.
Missionaries, they burnt down the German society or the German club or something, Port Elizabeth as well. That's all on record.
I've even come across in Cape Town's records that German butchers and bakers
Correct.
In Cape Town were burned out.
There.
Mobs in Cape Town burned out their shops just because they were German ancestry.
But they've been
it's the power of propaganda. It's hideous. As a direct result of Roosevelt's administration's flagrant misuse of patronage, budgetary trickery, propaganda, and repulsive demonization of New Deal opponents, to the point that our very system of self-government is in danger. And remember this quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. Now, that's interesting coming from him. You know, this isn't just an observation from Herbert Hoover. This is an observation, a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In politics, nothing happens by accident. And yet, all the time, they're telling it's happening by accident. Take, for example, this ISHCOM power failure. Is it just incompetence, which we know could justify it? But look at the timing. All this power failure is occurring at the very moment that they are saying that they're wanting feedback over the expropriation right compensation bill going through Parliament this December, which is a time of year when most people aren't noticing what's happening anyway, but now everyone's distracted with the power failures. Is it just an accident or is it a planned distraction? Most times in history, when something really evil is taking place, they have massive distractions. So that your attention's all over there while they pick your pocket, loot the country, or whatever the case may be. America's on a path of creeping collectivism, hostile to liberty itself. Economic and political freedom are organically connected. Right now in America, there's almost as many people working for a living as voting for a living. There's almost as many people on government welfare or working for the government as there are actually working and paying taxes. In South Africa, we've got vastly more people on welfare and working for the government than actually having a real job and actually producing something and working to pay their own bills. So in our country, already we've got more people voting for a living than working for a living, which is super dangerous. Hoover was convinced that American intervention in Europe's wars would ultimately be futile. We can make war, but we do not and we cannot make peace in Europe. Yeah, you can kill, but what can you do to bring those lives back again? Europe is a continent plagued with mixed populations, contested borders, and animosity stretching back 1,000 years, said Hoover. It's a snake pit, don't even get involved. If America were to ally itself with France, you'd find itself on the side of the dictatorial Soviet Union. America can best serve the world and liberty itself by staying aloof from Europe's wars. Just think how Switzerland has played a positive role in all the wars. By not being involved in them directly, they've had their Red Cross, they've had their humanitarian actions, they've received refugees, they've cared for people, they've kept things flowing, they've traded, they've aided, and they've often been the ones who've done negotiations to get prisoner exchanges and things like this. Switzerland's been a blessing to the world, not
they
a curse.
Had one Islamic terrorist because they knew before they get over the border
well,
they're armed.
Well, Switzerland is armed. It's armed neutrality. They're not pacifists. The Swiss are armed. They will defend their land, but they don't interfere with other people's affairs. So Hoover was convinced Germany did not want war with the Western powers, and that's definitely been proven, unless the democracies interfere with their spread eastwards. When on the 31st of March 1939, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain solemnly informed the House of Commons that the British government had provided a unilateral, that's unasked for, one-sided, war guarantee to Poland if the territory was threatened. Now, this didn't Poland wasn't obligated to defend Britain or to be on Britain's side. They asked nothing from Poland. It was an unconditional, unilateral, one-sided war guarantee to Poland. Yes.
I always thought that war guarantee was instituted at Versailles.
No. Started 31st of March, 1939. Everyone at the time was like, what? And Herbert Hoover, Pat Buchanan, a whole lot of others say, the dumbest thing ever done in British political history.
I was always under the impression it was part of the Versailles Agreement.
No. Hoover was absolutely, utterly astonished. It's simply throwing the body of Western civilization in front of Hitler's steamroller, which is on its way to Russia. Everyone knew National Socialism and International Socialism, Nationalism and Communism, were in for a life and death, cataclysmic Armageddon struggle. Why get in the way? Get out of the way. I mean, do you run into the road between two pentechnicons coming at one another? I mean, why would you do that? Hoover was convinced that by issuing its fateful guarantee to Poland, the British had committed a gigantic blunder, the greatest in their history. They had gotten in the way of the inevitable war between Hitler and Stalin. However, increasingly, President Hoover came to recognize that the greatest threat to America's peace and well-being was not coming from Berlin or from London, but from Washington, D.C., in the devious, meddlesome diplomacy of Franklin Roosevelt. I'm quoting word for word from Hoover's book. Here's another quote from Herbert Hoover. Older men declare war, but it's a youth that must fight and die, and it's a youth who must inherit the tribulation, the sorrow, and the triumphs that are the aftermath of the war. And, you know, I never questioned going to war, and I must say I still don't have any regrets, because we fought against terrorism, we fought to defend our country, we were fighting against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I believe South Africa's war was a just war, and I have no regrets about our war. I just have regrets about our politicians betraying us after we had won the war, that they gave away the country, after we hadn't lost a battle, hadn't even lost a skirmish. But my dad had some regrets, and he spent all 6 years in the Second World War in the Eighth Army. Ian Smith came to the conclusion of spending 6 years flying in the Royal Rhodesian Air Force in the Second World War, being shot down. Behind enemy lines, 5 months behind enemy lines, all of the different, half his face mangled, burnt plastic surgery and all this from another aircraft crash in North Africa. He came to the conclusion at the end, he was saying to me, we admit regularly, he said, you know, we were on the wrong side. We'd been better off sitting out the war. We'd been better losing the war. We'd been better off. Africa would still be free and safe. Millions have died because we were on the wrong side and we saved the Soviet Union, who was our real enemy. If we had to be involved in the war, we should have been fighting on the Eastern Front against the Soviet Union, not fighting against Eastern Front's enemies, Germany, who were protecting Europe from communism. And so Ian Smith came to that conclusion. And I've met a few people who, you know, people who fought in the Second World War who had regrets. And that's sad because I still look back and I think I'm proud of what we did in the SADF. I'm just sorry we didn't do it longer.
Hitler would have attacked Britain first.
Well, that would be different.
Britain would have fallen, and then he could have come against the Soviet Union because it would have been in summertime.
But he didn't want that.
Yeah, but that was his fault. He wasn't right in his head. It's because if Britain would have been fallen, they would have
but,
tried our metrics.
But you've got to understand. you've got to understand that Hitler continually wanted an alliance with Britain. Yeah. He was an Anglophile, and Hess was even more of an Anglophile. In fact, they said the entire top National Social Leadership Germany were serious Anglophiles. They loved English tea. They liked English styles of doing things. They wanted to model themselves on Great Britain. The Hitler Youth was totally Baden-Powell's scouts and girl guides. Exactly. Even the uniforms were modeled on him and everything they did there. The Kriegsmarine was modeled very much on the British. Gross Deutschland was modeled on Great Britain. They were the same people. And so he had this ideological affection, irrationally so, that his generals are saying, finish the British army now at Dunkirk. And he ordered the stop order and let the British all leave because he said they've got an empire to care for. We must think of the future. What would happen to the British Empire in the east of the Japanese? It was meant to be Britain. Do you know when Ribbentrop came to announce to Adolf Hitler that Singapore had fallen? And he wanted to put out a sort of congratulatory note. Adolf Hitler was grieving. He said, this is terrible. He said, for British civilization to suffer a loss of Singapore, their greatest citadel in the East. He said this signifies the fall of the European and the rise of the yellow men in Asia. He said this is not good for civilization. And a lot of his followers didn't understand this sentimentality towards Britain, that even when Britain was bombing their cities, blockading their ports, he still had such an affection to British, he was always holding his people back. Whereas the generals are thinking in a ruthless military sense, but you've got your enemy at your feet, destroy them before they'll continue the war and be a threat to us. But he wouldn't do it. And so there was, in fact, Air Vice Marshal Tedder of the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, said, Germany lost the war because it failed to apply the principles of total warfare. The British went to 24-hour, 7 days a week factory operations. They got all the women out of the home, mothers and lot, put them in the factories in the fields. Hitler never allowed the mothers of Germany to be mobilized. And in fact, they said there were something like 6 million German girls acting as maids in households of married women who could have been mobilized factory. And he wouldn't even let Albert Speer get hold of them. Speer said, we've got 18 million women who are not mobilized into the war effort that would free millions more men to the front lines. America's doing it, Britain's doing it, everyone else is doing it. We're the only country in the war not totally mobilized. And Hitler would not allow, to the end of the war, the mobilization of mothers or even their servants in the home who were there. So there was this sentimentality on many levels. And Germany never went to total war. They were not going to be having the women in the factories. And they weren't working even 24 hours in the factories until 1943, when it was a bit late.
Hitler had a mother complex. He was worshipping his mother.
Yeah,
well,
he was a queer. He got married just for show.
Well,
so, the queer is wrong by it in any case.
Well, I don't know about psychoanalyzing people of generations behind, but still. In 1939, July, Herbert Hoover proposed that all nations should agree not to attack food ships in wartime and not to bomb civilian populations, which is a very intelligent thing. He could tell a war's coming, and he's trying to say, let's at least not do what was done in the First World War, starvation blockades. Remember, he put a lot of effort to save people from starvation who were being hunger blockaded in the First World War. And bombing civilian populations is going to be catastrophic. Can't allow that. Food vessels should go freely and bombing should target only armies, navies, and ammunition works, never civilian populations. Wouldn't it have been nice if his insights and advice had been followed? Hoover urged a commission of neutral countries to manage the delivery of food to any blockaded countries, that civilian observers from neutral countries be stationed in belligerent countries to determine effects and to ensure that no civilians are bombed from the air. I mean, this man understood war and he wanted to alleviate its effects. Hoover's vision was of an American peaceful, humane, and politically neutral, like Switzerland, holding the light of liberty and the standards of decency in the world, devoted to law, economic cooperation, moral influence, a reduction of arguments, and relief for victims of persecution. Imagine if America had done this through the 30s and 40s and 50s. People around the world would love America, not hate it. People hate America not because they're free. They hate America because they bomb them and betray their governments and sanction them and wreck their countries. And when I brought this up to an American congressman while I was walking in Washington, D.C. in January 1988, first visit to America, this man gave the most frivolous response. I said, but you must understand, for every country we betray overseas, we get more choice of restaurants here in Washington, D.C. Look over there, there's the Mongolian restaurant, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, we've got Hungarian restaurants. And I was steaming because he was acting like this was a serious joke. He wasn't appreciating the lives that are destroyed. And the average American does not understand what's at the other side. You send cruise missiles into country. You send B-52 bombers. What do you think's happening on the ground? All of this, he said, would be jeopardized if America became a belligerent involved in these foreign wars. He emphasized that there's no issue in America, there's no issue in Europe, that America should go to war over. Whatever our sympathies are, we cannot solve the problems of Europe. And you could say it now. America can't solve the problems of the Middle East. Nor are they solving any problems in the Middle East. They're aggravating. Exactly. He urged that the sale of offensive weapons like bomber aircraft or submarines and any weapon that could terrorize civilians, such as bombs, should be totally prohibited. America should not be exporting weapons of war to belligerents, which actually was against the law according to 1920 anyway. Yet, as he documented, even while this was completely illegal, according to the laws of the United States, its president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was shipping colossal quantities. We're talking about millions of tons and billions of dollars worth of military weapons and transportation to Stalin's dictatorship in the Soviet Union. Hoover exposed the sheer hysteria being whipped up by FDR's speeches. He came to the conclusion that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was actually behind Great Britain's war guarantee to Poland and Poland's sudden unwillingness to negotiate handing back Danzig to Germany. And he got the evidence afterwards, speaking to the actual diplomats involved. The American president was whipping up a war scare to distract Americans from the total economic domestic failure of his administration. Isn't that typical? Fail at home, distract people from the war overseas. I do not for one moment believe that these democracies are in any danger of an attack from Germany. I mean, there's Germany, there's the Soviet Union, there's America and so on. Yeah, really. I'm convinced it is Roosevelt's action which has stirred public opinion in France and England into abandonment of their appeasement policy into an aggressive alliance. By doing so, Roosevelt had measurably advanced the possibilities of war in the world, and at the end of that war to save democracy will be that there is no democracy. This arsenal of democracy was saving the Soviet Union's dictatorship. FDR's sensational publicity stunts and public insults to Germany, warlike acts of economic sabotage marked a radical departure in American foreign policy, undermining liberty and unconstrained executive power. Hoover wrote against propaganda inflaming American emotions and minds and ominous steps taken by our own government which entangle us in these very controversies, the end of which may be war, and was war. I mean, just look at this kind of emotive propaganda. This world can exist half slave and half free. That comes from Lincoln's propaganda, what he said about the nation, which led them into the Civil War, which was a catastrophe. And this is now they're suggesting that you must actually wage war against other people who aren't run the way you want to be run. And then Hollywood came out with all kinds, and these actually, it turned out, Captain America and other Wonder Woman, they're all propaganda efforts by the American government. The Superman was also, and notice who Superman's enemy was? Lex Luthor. Why Luthor? Luthor's German, Protestant, and so on. And the people design this are Jewish, and they hate Luthor anyway. And so you've got this, so Superman was plainly Jewish, and Wonder Woman and Captain America, and all of this was anti-German, which was all propaganda, and that they've had a resurgence of this, well, the same people doing the propaganda past, doing the propaganda today. Fight for freedom. Well, my friends in Eastern Europe are outraged, insulted, and really very disgusted by us talking about what we did to them as freedom. We got no freedom. And even George Bush had to apologize for that. Look at this rubbish. Americans will always fight for liberty. Yeah, like this kind of liberty, where one man has the one vote. It's not who votes that counts, it's who counts the votes, said Stalin. He has joined the chessboard of Europe. FDR is lining us up in a balance of power condition fraught with moral peril. Just the fact of mobilizing women, who meant to be epitomes of love and nurture of life, to produce the weapons of war to blow other people's husbands and sons to pieces. Oh, not just them, but other people's mothers and daughters and sisters apart too, because most of these bombs are going to be dropped on cities anyway. Roosevelt engineered the U.S. entry into World War II against the law of the land, despite public and congressional anti-war sentiment, and despite his promise, solemn promise, never to send his men to foreign wars. The wise course would have been to stay out of it. The largest conflict in history was Operation Barbarossa. Germany mobilized against 5.7 million Soviet soldiers in the Red Army. Soviet Union had 316 divisions, 117,000 artillery pieces, 25,000 tanks, 18,000 combat aircraft. Germany at this time only had 5,000 Tuan tanks, of which they could only spare 3,300 on the Eastern Front. This gave the Soviets more than a 7-to-1 advantage in armor. And their tanks were bigger. Their artillery was bigger. Their armor was thicker. The idea that the German tanks were superior to the Russian armor, or the French armor for that matter, is not true. They were just better used, better run, but they didn't have bigger and longer range and so on. The Polish army was bigger than the German army. The French army was bigger than the German army at the beginning of the Second World War. The British had more bombers than Germany did. France had more tanks than Germany did. And you could carry on. But that's not a good story. So they've always got to have it that somehow they were, you know, the good guys, our guys, were outnumbered, which is not true. Germany was the ones who was always outnumbered, and they managed to win against great odds. The Luftwaffe had just 4,000 aircraft to oppose 18,000 aircraft in the Soviet Air Force. The largest military operation ever launched at that date was Operation Barbarossa. 2,900-kilometer front, 600,000 motor vehicles, 750,000 horses, and there were volunteers from all over Europe. You know that volunteers came to fight communism from, and I thought this post is interesting, you know, making books available for the men at the front. I thought they burnt books. No, they burnt pornography and communism. They weren't against books. Nazis burnt books, but free Americans can still read them. Well, actually, the Germans did read books. That's how they managed to make the world's first jet aircraft, and they managed to make the first rockets, and that's why several thousand German scientists were taken by America back to organize their Apollo space programs on. They burned propaganda and pornography, the sort of thing we burn at Kwasibantu fire services, you know, that sort of thing. These volunteers came from all over Europe. There were people from Spain. There were people who came from France, from Norway, from Sweden, even neutral countries like Switzerland, from Denmark. This was a real international crusade against Bolshevism. See the Edelweiss from the Alps on the side. In the first day, one quarter of the Soviet Union's air force was destroyed. The German blitzkrieg tactics devastated the Red Army, made stupendous progress on the steppes of Russia. They made advances like the world has never seen in history, and they were received by grateful, cheering people throughout the captive nations of the Soviet Union, who saw the Germans as their liberators. Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, all happily joined. By October, 3 million Red Army soldiers had already been taken prisoners of war. But it was a logistical nightmare. The further they went into Russia, the less there were roads and railways, and the logistical complications were compounded. And the army bogged down in the mud, and the frontline troops couldn't get resupplied easily. Horses were, in many cases, used more even than tanks. The German propaganda focused on the tanks, but they used horses more than they used vehicles, actually. 750,000 horses for 600,000 motor vehicles and tanks. But the cold, the winter, the freezing, biting, icy winter was one of the worst. But they were winning. They were getting to Moscow. What the Germans did not know, and what nobody could have anticipated, was the vast amount of aid which the United States of America would give to save the Soviet Union. Before America had even entered World War II officially, before Pearl Harbor, America was secretly shipping vast amounts of weaponry, which the people in the factories thought was going to Britain, but most of it was going to the Soviet Union. On 24th June 1941, 6 months before the Pearl Harbor attack, President Roosevelt held a press conference in which he announced America would give all possible help to Stalin's Soviet Union. Why? What had happened in June 1941? Well, Germany had just invaded the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union was the worst government on the planet, the most antichrist government in the history of mankind. Why would America, the bastion of freedom, use the arsenal of democracy to help save Stalin's Soviet Union? And this was open. That idea was not well received within America. An opinion poll in July 1941 found 54% of Americans were opposed to sending any aid to the Soviet Union. Roosevelt persisted, and the vast amount of aid continued to flow. At this, America put Britain up to, you must seize Iceland. Iceland was neutral. Britain invaded Iceland to provide America with an easy port for their ships going to Murmansk to help on the Arctic convoys. And so Iceland was just annexed. And so the United States, yes, the United States was able to be shipping through to the Northern Fleet to help Soviet Union with aid before they went to war. And you just cannot imagine how much. Also, they made a corridor through Iran into Russia. And this was a joint British and Soviet operation to overthrow the Shah of Iran and to seize control of Iran, its strategic railroad. And they just swept through, and in the handover to America, and America was able to rail in most of the aid to Soviet Union came through Iran. You wonder why the people in Iran are angry with America. They've toppled their elected governments and their shahs several times, actually. And it's absolutely outrageous. Then there was the Alaska-Siberia aircraft where they literally directly flew vast amounts of aid to Russia from Alaska. Fighting fit in the factory. And the gifts to Stalin boggle the brain. 13,000 tanks and armored vehicles sent. Sherman tanks, Lee and Grant tanks, vast amounts of weapons from America, the Lee and Grant. The T-34, the British Crusader tanks, all sent to the Soviet Union to aid them. And you won't generally see pictures of those because in most films they'd want to hide the fact of a huge amount. Here's a Churchill tank in the steppes of Russia. This was how it operated. 14,795 military aircraft, bombers. Russia couldn't have made all these weapons, let alone as good. Here's an American bomber with a Soviet crew, which the Americans are helping them to learn how to use. American aircraft, Soviet Red Star, entire squadrons made up, 77,000 jeeps, 375,000 trucks. General Motors and Ford not only sent them trucks, they built factories in Russia beyond the Urals, which they helped them mobilize and build even more. 35,000 motorcycles, 8,000 tractors, 15,000 artillery pieces, 131,000 heavy machine guns, 1,981 locomotives, 90 cargo ships, 4.5 million tons of food supplies, over $1 billion of machinery and equipment, 2,670,000 tons of petroleum products, 49,000 tons of leather, 3.7 million tires, 15.5 million pairs of army boots, 106 million tons of cotton. That's a lot of cotton. Building equipment valued at another 10 billion. Non-iron metals, 802,000 tons. They call it Russia's lifesaver. 29 shipping tankers, 433 combat ships, 2 million tons of petroleum products, mobile bridges, railway equipment, aircraft, radio, nearly 500,000 tons of explosives, 1.4 billion rounds of small arms ammunition, 21 million rounds of cannon ammunition, 37 millimeters and larger, raw explosives enough to load 60 million artillery shells, 270,000 tons of rolled steel enough to manufacture another 15,000 T-34 tanks. And all of this U.S. effort resulted in an immense quantity and quality of war materials delivered to the Soviet Union, which the Soviet Union could never provide for themselves. Germany was destroying the entire Soviet Air Force and Tank Corps in the first few weeks of the war. And then they were, why are we still meeting war? Where's all this coming from? Nobody could have imagined, why would the freest country on earth, Christian America, be aiding atheist communist Soviet Union? It didn't make any sense. Didn't make sense then, doesn't make sense now. The vast amount of weaponry that they shipped in, 3,600 miles of railway track. And it just carries on, right down to 257 million buttons. Shoe polish, just staggering. And this doesn't include the very generous aid given by Great Britain to the Soviet Union. We thought Britain was suffering. I mean, South Africa was working around the clock to provide Britain with aid because poor little Britain struggling there, you know, holding on and so on. They could still give the Soviet Union 5,000 tanks, 5,500 buffers, anti-aircraft guns, 12 minesweepers, 5,800 aircraft, including some of the best aircraft in the world at that time, 3,300 Hurricanes and 1,000 Spitfires. I thought they had too few, but they could give thousands to the Soviet Union. You know, immeasurably better than their yaks. Oh, it's just, you know, $1.7 billion worth of supplies to Stalin's Soviet Union. I mean, again, just imagine you're in a boxing ring and other chap can bring a few thousand others to help him. Or you playing a football match and they can suddenly put a few divisions on the other side against your 11. It's not an even battle. But why would Britain do this? Canada, another 2,700 tanks and armored vehicles to the Soviet Union, 1 million artillery shells, another 208,000 tons of wheat and flour. Without this Western aid, the Soviet Union would have been finished. Kaput. Defeated. Liberated. Over. History.
Canada worked together with America because otherwise the Americans couldn't get to Alaska, which they bought for a dollar from the Russians.
Allies in it. There's no doubt that without Western aid, the Soviet Union wouldn't have been able to survive that first year. That would have been the end of it. Russian historian Boris Sokolov wrote in 1998, Lend-Lease was the decisive factor in the Soviet ability to continue the war. And do you know that we supplied the gold? South Africa. South Africa shipped all our gold to America, care of USS Quincy. And once the gold arrived in New York, then Lend-Lease started to flow. Now, South Africa probably thought the gold was going to help Britain. Didn't realize we were also paying for the Soviet Union's aid. So America didn't even do this for free. Okay, they didn't charge Russia, but South Africa paid to save the Soviet Union. We provided the gold, and America provided the weaponry. And the British helped directly. They actually flew missions over Murmansk. They trained the Soviet personnel. And there we thought Britain didn't have enough to protect their little island, but they could spare vast amounts for the Soviet Union. And the British Navy suffered a lot. I mean, just one convoy, PQ-17, lost 24 merchant ships sunk out of 35 dispatched, and they lost 153 seamen, 210 aircraft, 430 tanks, 100,000 tons of munitions. That was just one convoy. The human cost of the people trying to save the Soviet Union, also, what a waste. And the battles, the odds, and it's just extraordinary. But that's another story. The colossal American military aid shipped to Stalin's Soviet Union was neither morally defensible nor was it wise. Why would you aid your future enemy? Now, people have said it was a bit stupid that America trained Osama bin Laden to fight the Russians in Afghanistan, because once the Russians left Afghanistan, what's he going to do? Fight America with American weaponry and training. Thank you very much. And here you can see the vast amounts of aid, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars poured into the Soviet Union Lend-Lease. So capitalist Christian America effectively salvaged communist atheist dictatorship in Russia from collapsing and helped to fuel and arm and fund the greatest military threat to Western civilization, the Soviet Union. And it just reminds you of what Lenin said, the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang them. Major Jordan's diaries document that he was in charge of one of the supply aircraft's flights going out of Alaska into Russia, and he is regularly told by State Department, don't record this flight, don't list, don't even ask what's in these boxes and crates. And there was a whole lot of things that's not on the list. Now, what I've read you is the official list. But according to Major Jordan, a vast amount wasn't even documented. Who knows what else they were sending them? Russia's lifesaver indeed. 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2 says, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. Why is God angry with the West? Killing our own babies and helping commies kill Christians. Freedom Betrayed documents the treacherous role played by the Soviet Union in fomenting the Second World War, escalating the Second World War, bailing out and supporting the worst mass murdering dictatorship in the world, Stalin's Soviet Union, and betraying 15 nations of Eastern and Central Europe and 100 million Christians in them to the hideous oppression of communist Russia and its NKVD secret police who became the KGB. The Iron Curtain cut a continent for 45 years from north to south, from Stettin in the north to Trieste in the south. 1,200 communist concentration camp hellholes in which 50 million Christians ended their days in Arctic hellhole conditions. In camps like these, being starved, iced, frozen, bludgeoned, American territory was never threatened by Germany. Western Europe wouldn't have been affected either, if it had not attempted to stop Germany's eastward push to reclaim its lands and people taken away by the vindictive Versailles Treaty. Instead, by partnering with Stalin to defeat Germany, Roosevelt and Churchill gave communism legitimacy and provided the essential support that prevented the Soviet Union from collapsing as Operation Barbarossa was launched. Now, we are taught in our history today a kind of predestination, an inevitability. Oh, well, Germany could never have won the Second World War. But actually, when you study it, they had lots of chances to win. There was many chances. There's no way they could have foreseen what was coming from America or from the cracking of the codes or the GCHQ and cracking the Enigma codes and the fact that they already knew all of their plans ahead of time. And there were so many things. Who could have imagined capitalist America saving the Soviet Union? Germany had looked at it. They looked at Soviet Union's capabilities and they knew we can beat them. And they did. But what they couldn't do is beat the Soviet Union and the United States of America with South Africa's gold and Canada and Britain's generosity and Spitfires and Sherman tanks and everything else. You know, it was just over and over. And even then, they still had a chance. And it just was not right what we did. Worse, by acceding to the Soviet Union's dictators' territorial commands, they betrayed the very principles of universal self-determination that proclaimed in the Atlantic Charter. What about freedom for Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and Poland, and East Germany, and Czech, and Slovakia, and Hungary, and Romania, and all the countries of Yugoslavia and Bulgaria? And what about the Ukraine? By November 1943, secret communications and commitments by the Allies at the Tehran Conference constituted the greatest blows to human freedom in this century. I think that's absolutely right. Notice this New York Times. Roosevelt, Stalin, Churchill agree on plans for war in Germany. In talks at Tehran, 1,500 more tons of bombs dropped on Berlin. That's all one headline. The Soviet Union would be allowed to annex Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Bessarabia, Bukovia, parts of Finland and Poland, and to secure a periphery of friendly border states. In other words, satellites. Thus, 15 countries, 100 million Christians, betrayed to communism. The independent life and freedoms they'd enjoyed were snuffed out. Now, you can read about these people's lives and sufferings in Bill Bethman's Going Through book. And Bill Bethman introduced me to many of these people who suffered in these countries directly because of the Soviet Union being bailed out by United States, Canada, Great Britain, and sadly even South Africa's gold, thanks to Smuts. Hoover documents Roosevelt's repeated assurances to Stalin that America would do nothing to thwart Soviet territorial ambitions in Europe. This man was the greatest useful idiot the communists ever had, or he was a communist himself. Freedom betrayed indicates Roosevelt for instigating the war in the Pacific as well, and that's another story. Economic sanctions against Japan, shunning Japanese peace overtures, sparking the Pearl Harbor attack, ultimately leading to the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which Herbert Hoover calls the act of unparalleled brutality in all of American history. Hoover cites other markers on the slippery slope of Stalin alliance, the Yalta Agreement, giving the Kuril Islands and Sakhalin Island to Russia. Why? In exchange for promised help of dubious value, which was unnecessary for fighting Japan. The broken agreement with the nationalist leader of China, Chiang Kai-shek, who is married to a Christian, to consult him on matters pertaining to Asia, the betrayal of China, the betrayal of North Korea to communism. As you can see, this is the result. The Soviet Union was given all of Eastern Europe and Central Europe, able to take over Mongolia, North Korea, and China. Because the West had conveniently destroyed the bulwark protecting Europe from communism in Europe, Germany, and the bulwark protecting Asia from communism in Asia, and that was Japan. How convenient. Remove the main obstacles to Stalin. So Herbert Hoover's book also documents a systematic betrayal of anti-communist forces throughout Europe and Asia by the U.S. State Department. General Douglas MacArthur is quoted as personally having told Herbert Hoover, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had provoked war in the Pacific against Japan by economic warfare, total blockade in oil, rubber, and other essential strategic minerals while Japan was involved in a life-and-death struggle against the communists in China. As the U.S. Navy had cracked the Japanese codes, the U.S. government was fully aware of the impending attack on Pearl Harbor, chose not to warn their forces there. FDR's administration wanted war with Japan to justify their colossal support to salvage Stalin's Soviet Union, which at that very moment was in danger of being overwhelmed in Operation Barbarossa. General MacArthur was convinced that war with Japan was forced on it by U.S. policy. Japan did not want war with America any more than Germany wanted war with Britain. And the use of the atomic bombs to end the war was not only immoral, but militarily unnecessary. The Japanese had been seeking peace for months before the atomic bombs were dropped on the two most Christian centers of Japan, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, wiping out 15,000 Christians with the atom bombs, the core nucleus of the Christian communities in Japan.
Japan wouldn't even have surrendered because of the two atomic wars. They just surrendered because the Soviets were closing in from the north. That's what they could be.
Well, that's one theory, but bear in mind, they were already starving. Their navy was defeated. Their air force was impotent. The Americans were bombing them all the time. And they had no raw materials of their own. And so they were under blockade. So just sheer naval blockade alone would have forced them to seek peace. But that's another story. These are three of the most evil men of the 20th century. And they have been portrayed, at least two of them, being portrayed as great heroes.
Don't insult Churchill.
Uh-huh. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will stand up for me against the workers of iniquity? So, some of the sources that back up Herbert Hoover: Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the greatest Russian author of the 20th century. He documented the nature of communism. He was in the concentration camp for years, an intellectual giant of the 20th century. The Gulag Archipelago, giving a name to those 1,200 concentration camps. Others have documented the betrayal of 3 million Russians, Ukrainian, East Europeans, of which 2 million were Russians themselves, betrayed from Western Europe into Eastern Europe. Here, some of them who were in Austria, being forced by British bayonets and tanks across the river into the hands of NKVD, who were murdering them. This was sealed for 30 years. We only found out about this in 1975. James Bach documented the shocking truth of other losses, where more German soldiers died after the Second World War in Allied concentration camps than died in combat on all fronts during 6 years of the war. It's Eisenhower's death camps. The worst military butcherer, really, was Eisenhower, who wasn't a soldier. He never fired a shot in anger. He never heard a shot fired in anger. He was a politician who went from being major to being four-star general in a matter of months because he met FDR's daughter at a cocktail party in Washington, and she said, "Wait right here. Dad, I found just the man to run your war in Europe." And Eisenhower went from nothing to being commander-in-chief. James Bach, French-speaking Canadian, has also documented how something in a region of 15 million German civilians died under Allied occupation between 1944 and 1950. The greatest genocide imaginable, and yet we now think of the Germans as the culprits, as the cause of genocide, not as the victims of it. So cleverly has it been switched. Just like today, many people think the worst racists in the world are white South Africans, and black South Africans are the victims. But in fact, the reality is more like black South Africans are some of the worst racists on the planet, and white South Africans are the worst victims of racism in the world. That's the reality. But most people in the world have bought the propaganda, which enables the criminals to continue with their atrocities, farm murders and so on, and looting the country. And so it was looting of Germany, the greatest economic power of Europe, and the destruction, not just looting of their art treasures and their scientific treasures and their patents. They loaded vast amounts of ships, just taking over to America, things just stolen from Germany. Germany was looted on so many different levels. And they killed millions and stole vast amount of territory. How do you do that to a great people? Well, you've got to guilt manipulate them that they don't want to fight back. And that's what's been done to the white South Africans too. Ex-communists have documented in the Black Book of Communism, also justifying what Herbert Hoover is saying, 100 million people killed by the Soviet Union and its allies in the 20th century between 1917 and 1991, according to the Soviet Union's own documents, own archives. There's documentation of other atrocities and massacres of Germans, like at Bleiburg. Death by Government by Professor Rommel also backs him up on this. The greatest killers are secular humanist states. Patrick Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and Unnecessary War, well documents how Britain lost its empire and the West lost the world. Peter Padfield's Hess, Hitler, and Churchill, The Real Turning Point, the Second World War, A Secret History, showing how the deputy Führer, the number two in Germany, man just under Hitler, flies unarmed in unarmed aircraft for the first time in his life, parachutes. I mean, he'd been a pilot, but he'd never parachuted in his life, in the dark, into Scotland. He should have got the Nobel Peace Prize for trying to end war with Britain, negotiate peace. I mean, how much better to do it than the deputy leader of Germany? And he wanted peace with Britain before the attack on the Soviet Union. He had always been advocating peace with Britain. He is an Anglophile. And they treated him so shamefully, drugs and every kind, mind-altering type of drugs even, and never let him talk to another living soul about the war and what he knew. Not a journalist, not a historian, until he was finally murdered in the 1980s. And how the Soviet Union KGB ran the British MI5 and MI6, and a whole lot of other things too, including the British nuclear contingent to the Manhattan Project. And these things are documented. Peter Wright documenting how even the head of MI5, M himself, was a KGB agent, Sir Roger Hollis, and so on. The book that has changed my view of the Second World War even more than all these is The Secret War. Max Hastings has looked at the war, the Second World War, entirely in terms of spies, codes, and guerrillas from 1939 to 1945, using the previously sealed for 60 years. And when a government seals something for 60 years, they're hiding something. And as has been said by generals writing in the foreword of this book, this requires every history book, Second World War, and documentary to be redone, because this is the story from the intelligence perspectives and the code breakers and so on outside. And it's not the story you're getting from Hollywood and the way that most people have perceived when you understand all the incredible devious things that were going on. To understand some of the results of the betrayal of people like in Eastern Europe, we showed the film recently of Richard Wurmbrand, tortured for Christ, 14 years in a communist prison. And others have documented the hideous atrocities in occupied Germany. And Mike Walsh has done a lot of that. Hellstorm, if you've got a strong stomach, as to the atrocities of the Allies when they took Germany. To understand how communism is behind all of this, Agenda 2, Masters of Deceit, excellent documentary. To understand what was done to the Ukraine, Bitter Harvest, a good documentary, drama that shows you some insights into what it was like for the farmers in Ukraine when they got their expropriation without compensation in the 1930s. And Senator Joe McCarthy, who fought against the communists in American government, and how he was blacklisted by history. And of course, traitor to his class, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the privileged life and radical presidency of FDR, one of the worst leaders in the history of the world. So, any questions, any comments? Yes, it is. Quite right.
I would just like to go back to the ESCOM story then. Sir Kochman, of course, talked about, what did he say? It was stole the 2,000 megawatt.
Sabotage.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was quite right about sabotage.
Yeah.
ANC sabotage ESCOM. From the beginning.
They've also looked
at Abu Bakr, who let the Gupta's in, to Mokrante, who didn't even know anything about it because it was only a short time, and then Jacob Sumo stole the whole 11-hour track. SIA was the third best available airline in the world when I flew down in 1980 from Austria.
SIA was one of the top best. It was along with Swiss Air and Lufthansa. They were sort of like between them, the three top best.
And the technicians.
Yeah. Now, it's sad. There was a time when South African was excellent.
And now was the best munition manufacturer. They built that Royal Falk helicopter, which the Americans then named Apache. And stole it from South Africa. They had the atom bomb, yeah.
Yeah, and they even had to buy a G5s, a G6 for the Gulf War because ours were the best artillery in the world.
There's often a thinking behind, it's like this, the long game is being played, all right, where the final solution is a completely, basically the idea is to have communism as an enemy, but eventually we want to make communism over everything.
Yes.
So the long game is communist control over everything, even though...
New world order.
Yeah. Well, basically, that's what it is. It's a long game. So it's, so in other words, it has to be, the only way you can unite the world is through a totalitarian sort of regime. It's the only way you can do it. You can't do it. People aren't going to buy into it voluntarily.
Revelation 13. One world government, one world religion, one world economy.
Yeah. But the only way, but what I'm saying is these events, like First World War, Second World War, Cold War, it's almost like these guys have been playing a 120-year-long game.
Yes.
It's quite something.
It's very, very devious. And it even goes back to South Africa in the days of Cecil Rhodes, when Rothschild gave him £1 million check loan to launch Consolidated Mines, De Beers, and all that sort of thing. And why? Why would they? Was he so generous? What was the goal? But South Africa had the gold, and they had their plans. And that's why the Anglo-Boer War targeted. Why would Britain care about a bunch of farmers in the Transvaal and the Free State? And they mobilized over 480,000 troops from around the world to come here to our shores to destroy 30,000 farms and imprison vast amounts of Boer women and children, wiping them out at a rate of a quarter of the population a year in their camps. It's a worse death rate than in any camps in the Second World War. And they couldn't have said, well, gee, you know, our railways were being bombed and the bridges were being bombed. They controlled them all. And they still deliberately starved the people to that extent. So going back to 1899 to 1902, Anglo-Boer War, you already saw the New World Order was, and South Africa was one of the targets even then.
It's been claimed that the Anglo-Boer War, many historians have said that was the beginning of the end of the British Empire.
It was the moral end, that's for sure.
A lot of people put the end of the British Empire as the Anglo-Boer War stopped there.
It was such a disgrace.
Yeah, you were just mentioning M. So was M, the M character in the Bond movies?
Yes.
Is he like
actually in the 1940s, 50s, into the 60s, M was actually a KGB agent. Yes. So when the Bond books were being written, the M, the actual M, was Sir Roger Hollis. He is a proven KGB agent. He is the fifth man of the Cambridge Five. Yeah. According to Peter Wright in his book Spycatcher.
What we notice and what we see so far is that these countries actually embracing godlessness. They also, you find out that they come against the doctrine of Germany, but religious school was totally different. Like history over the years, you see the world cover ups. What you see is that these countries actually embraced godlessness and made a pact with the devil. You look at all the
pact with the devil, indeed. In fact, even in British Parliament, Winston Churchill, when challenged from people on the ground, like Mr. Rhys Davies, who was the father of my high school teacher as a member of Parliament in Rhodesia, Rhys Davies was imprisoned without trial as member of Parliament for challenging Winston Churchill about, you've made a pact with the devil. And Churchill responded, if Hitler involved hell, I would make a pact with Satan himself. Which actually he did. I would say he was well in league with the devil. There have been books that have come out showing that while Winston Churchill was married and had children, he actually was also involved in homosexual perversion, and he was actually quite a nasty piece of work in many different ways. He's a person who would, he would get up at about 11 in the morning and have a long bath with full massive breakfast and so on, with his secretary having to take dictation from him in the bath while he luxuriated there for about an hour with his cigars and his whiskey. And he is the most self-indulgent, well, even more so than FDR, who was really self-indulgent. boozer and all that, total, very immoral. But Winston Churchill was even more immoral and even more, what do you call it, hedonistic.
And they had locked him up in South Africa and let him go.
Well, they didn't let him go. He gave his word of honor as a gentleman that he wouldn't attempt to escape. And so they weren't guarding him, but then he managed to escape because his word of honor obviously wasn't worth much. Yeah. So when I've been in Britain and American people asked my opinion about Winston Churchill, I said, well, you must understand I'm a South African, so we're not particularly excited about a person who was positive about war crimes against their own population. He totally supported the scorched earth and the concentration camp policy. He said, you can't expect me to get excited about a man who's a war criminal in our own country.
Is there anything positive?
Germany killed more communists than any other country in history. Nobody killed more communists than Germany did in the Second World War. America didn't even scratch 1% of how many communists the German army managed to wipe out. If the Americans think they fought communists in the Cold War, even if you took their, what do you call them, proxies, like when they were helping the Sandinistas and so on, nobody has been more serious in killing communists in Germany. What Germany achieved in the Second World War, technologically, I would say the greatest population of the 20th century, the greatest generation, was the German people who fought in the Second World War that endured the bombings. Think of the courage and the tenacity of these people who could endure entire Armageddon-type end-of-the-world scenarios of their world being blown apart around them, and they stood firm. They never cracked. What phenomenally tough, courageous, bold, brave people, and that they rebuilt their country, and they soon eclipsed the victors in productivity, and after the towns were turned to burning rubble, and the economy soared, and they were still beating them at football even after 2014. So I must say, even though my father was on the other side, my dad never had a bad word to say about the Germans. He said, I remember watching a World at War film and asked what he thought. And he said, I don't believe it. And I said, don't believe what? He said, I don't believe any of it. The World at War, that's a big series of films, 1975. And he said, my dad said, the Germans are honorable men. They were gentlemen. They were decent people. Erwin Rommel was the best. He said, there was no atrocities in North Africa. Not one. I don't believe any of this. Now, that's someone who fought there. And I've spoken to other Canadians, British, Aussies, and so on, who fought in the Second World War, captured at Tobruk, ended up in German camps. And I've had someone say, you know, we were never mistreated by Germans, not once. People are prisoners for 2 years in German camps. They said, you know, we were hungry towards the end. The last few months, we were all hungry. But the guards were just as hungry. We were all starving. But that's because of the bombing. It wasn't policy. It was just reality of living in a continent being bombed around the clock by 1,000 bomber raids. So, you know, it's not tough for me to decide between do I believe a paedophile like Spielberg or do I believe my father and other people who fought in the Second World War. I'll take an eyewitness any day over some antichrist pagan in Hollywood, cocaine-sniffing drug addicts.
So, Peter, who was that guy that you mentioned who was actually calling the war, the group war?
Oh, you know, I've forgotten his name right now. He's not a very, very famous name. It's one of the Jewish Hollywood directors and so on. He came out with this name. Sorry? He certainly helped popularize it. But I don't think he's not the inventor of it. I don't think it was him either. It was someone before. He certainly, again, popularized it heavily. And, of course, there's been people like Tom Hanks who picked this up in the Greatest Generation. I've met the Greatest Generation. Honestly, they're some of the most selfish, stupid, ill-informed people on the planet who just, I've got to bomb Syria. And do you even know where Syria is? Why should you bomb Syria? And they were astounded. I'd be the guest speaker for somebody. And don't you agree we've got to bomb Syria? No, I don't. No, but we have to. Well, what do you know about Syria? And they knew nothing. I said, Second largest number of Christians in the Middle East. 6% of the population in Syria are Christians. They're protected by the government there. It's a secular government, not an Islamic government. They protect them from the radical Islamists. Why are you wanting to take the side of the Islamic terrorists against a government that's protecting the Christians? In fact, a disproportionate amount of the Syrian army are Christians because they know this is their only hope to keep them from being beheaded and their families being sold into slavery. So, yes, going back 2,000 years. So, in fact, when we were watching the Passion of the Christ film, you were seeing Syrians and Assyrian Christians because they were the people that still speak Aramaic. And so Mel Gibson was recruiting people from there, from those very churches that are being attacked by ISIS and NATO and Turkey and all this. Or American cruise missiles. So, yes, unfortunately, this greatest generation is a product of propaganda. In Afrikaans, they speak about smearing honey around a person's mouth. So they've been smearing honey around the mouth of this greatest generation of age. You went through the Second World War, even if you were peeling potatoes in Iowa, you're the greatest generation. And they've been, they have them stand and all applaud in churches and everything else at different times, Memorial Day. And of course, there's all kinds of benefits. And even though many of the people didn't see much, who minds being idolized and praised, So many of them have gone with us. But they've done nothing to stop abortion, pornography, and all these other things in their own country. And now they're the greatest generation. So I know it's not politically correct, but I started saying years ago in America, I don't see how they can be called the greatest generation. I said, I think they're the worst generation in America's history. America's never lost more freedoms than in their lifetime while they were the people doing the voting. So so-called greatest generation, hideous. Yes.
I also noticed that over the years, I've noticed that Dr. Cookman's came out of the name Uber. The vehicles recently, Uber. I don't know whether it's related to the same person.
I don't know. There were two very famous Hoovers.
J. Edgar Hoover's
the other very famous one. He's the one who founded the FBI and built up the FBI.
He was a bad guy.
50 years.
He was a bad guy.
Well, possibly, but he did a lot to fight communism.
He
was not... he locked up a lot of them and shot quite a few of them and things like that. So, his G-men brought down Dillinger and Al Capone and all that sort of thing. So he wasn't a bad guy. And totally. Yes, well, well, clean sweep. But J. Edgar Hoover, there's mixed bag. But he had the dirt on every American president, apparently. J. Edgar Hoover. Because in the FBI... That's why he lost 50 years, because whenever anyone, whether it was Nixon or Kennedy, whoever wanted to fire him, he had to let them know about all these files he had.
He was the original deep state operative.
So basically, they couldn't get rid of him because he had all the dirt on all of them.
The original deep state operative.
It's just quite funny, but yeah.
Coming back to South Africa, when they let our hero terrorist Mandela free, and he then became president, he didn't do anything apart from the killing of abortion. Apart from that, he never did anything. But Mercedes-Benz sponsored him a brand new red Mercedes-Benz S-Class.
Well, red's quite appropriate.
Okay. He received the car, he sent it straight back to the factory. He's been restrained too long in prison, they must take out the seatbelts and rather put a dark girl on the back.
Okay, I've got the feeling this is a bit apocryphal. Okay.
Then when you said you can keep the car, I'll take the tires. And if she had 365 tires, it was a good year.
I thought we had to send it back because you found a stompy in the ashtray.
No, she stopped smoking at the age of 50. That's when she killed the last one.
Yeah.
On a serious note, sir.
On a serious note, yes.
Yeah. I noticed that the ANC, I can personally recall this, that they were bombing substation in the early times. They were terrorists.
Yes.
And we actually, when we were in the police force years ago, we attended some of those bombing substations. And today, look what is happening in terms of ESCO, the loss of power and the cost that we pay for it. And the same, ANC is ruling now.
Yeah.
The body there.
And those bombers are also now hailed in the school textbooks as heroes for the
Yeah, of course.
Yes, so putting a terrorist in a police uniform doesn't make him a lawman, and putting a coward who only knew how to run away and kill civilians into a soldier's uniform doesn't make him a soldier, and so on. So you have people, all they've done is undermine the economy by strikes, stayaways, and so on. You make the Minister of Economics, and then you've got somebody who all he did was don't pay taxes and so on, and you make him Minister of Economics. You could just imagine, no wonder the country's not working, because you've got a bunch of criminal thugs that you've put into high office. What did they think was going to happen?
I mean, the thing is, if you take South Africa politically, there's no opposition. There are no opposition parties in South Africa, really. I mean, the DA is a joke. The new interim leader,
they have a new interim leader?
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, whatever. But people were saying, the comments were made that he wasn't even educated at all. That's not the problem with this new interim leader. The problem is this new leader has never had a job in his life. He entered politics at 22 and he's never left. That's the problem with this guy. He's never had a job in
career politics are a curse.
I mean, and now that is supposed to now be the opposition to this whole thing.
How can you
expect somebody who is essentially embedded in the system to be opposing anything? He's part of, like everybody else, they are part of the system.
Parasites on the system, yeah. That's why, you know, Margaret Thatcher was such a good prime minister. She was a grocer's daughter. She knew how economies worked. And so there were several times in her cabinet, she'd say, how many of you know the price of milk, loaf of bread? And, you know, nobody in the cabinet, but she knew. In fact, even while prime minister, she would do her own shopping. She knew the price of everything. She knew what it cost for a normal person to live. And these idiots in the cabinet had no idea what life was like for a person in the street. She's the one person in the cabinet actually understood what was going on in the real economy. Well, they would often taunt Margaret Thatcher because she is, you know, a grocer's daughter, and said, yes, and I know the price of things. And which, of course, they didn't. In the EU, do you know they've got 10,000 officials, unelected officials in the EU, who get a higher salary than the Prime Minister of Great Britain? 10,000.
In their parliament and their Brussels.
And they've got this president of the EU who nobody knows and nobody's voted for.
You ever seen the European Parliament?
Yeah.
It looks like a power federal.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I've got notes for tonight. Freedom Betrayed, it's colossal, and believe it or not, there's even more in the notes than I skip. That's 10 pages on Freedom Betrayed. But to summarize a 900-page book in 10 pages is, yeah, it's not easy. And then there's also... Sorry?
We can make it a book for the next question.
In fact, it's quite expensive. I've also got shipped to a person I speak to at this church in America, so I brought it back. The cost of the postage alone for American information.
No, it's ridiculous.
But it's good revenue. You can beat someone to death with it. So we've just got back from the printer today, Family News, and I've got the sermon notes from this last Sunday.
On there, which is on...
What's the title of it?
That's it. The sermon last Sunday on the Kingdom of God. That's on the table. And just to remind you, Christmas season for evangelism. We've got the greatest man who ever lived, and it's available in Afrikaans too, so we can get those and bring those out. And if you've got any other Christmas tracks, you can just bring those on the table afterwards too. So do make use of those, and of course these notes on Freedom Betrayed. I think you can switch off the projector there. So let's pray. Pray for the upcoming events and all that's still coming, and at the beginning.